Welcome to Catholic Radio Indy's Lunchtime Podcast Sampler. I'm Kent Blanford. Each week, we'll bring you a sampling of some of the best Catholic podcasts being prepared and shared out there on the internet. We have now entered into the season of Lent. We are called to fasting and abstinence, but how do you get the wee ones in your homes to understand the concept of fasting? To help us out with that, we have an episode of Kyle Heineman's Catholicism with My Kid, and a look at why do we fast, how should we fast?
Are you fast, Frank?
Yeah, I'm pretty fast.
How fast?
Pretty fast.
I don't know that pretty fast is a really measurement of speed. You can't just say it, put a sign on the side of the road that says, don't go pretty fast. You can go fast, but don't go pretty fast.
So I guess I go 20 or 30 miles an hour.
Yeah. I don't think you do. Running?
No, in
or
a car.
Or when you're in a car. That doesn't count.
Or on a bicycle. Actually, I go 70 usually in a car.
I'm Kyle Heineman.
And I'm his son, Frank.
And this is Catholicism with My Kid. So Frank, today I want to talk about fasting. Okay, what do you know about fasting?
You don't eat much.
Okay. Why?
Because you're giving up for Jesus.
Okay. Why would he want us to not eat much? Just to give us something to do? You guys look too happy. You should give something up. For me.
Nah, I don't think that's what it is.
So, the church has a couple different expectations for us for fasting. Do you have any idea when we're supposed to fast?
In Lent.
Okay. Specifically when in Lent?
Specifically Friday.
Okay.
Good Friday.
Good Friday. Friday's in Lent. And what starts Lent?
Sunday?
No.
Wednesday?
Ash Wednesday.
Yes, I got it. First try.
Okay. So I think it's anybody over the age of 14 is supposed to give up meat on Ash Wednesday, and then Fridays during Lent, Good Friday. And then anybody...
What about Black Friday?
Black Friday has nothing to do with the church. Black Friday is when people spend a lot of money after Thanksgiving.
But why do they spend a lot of money?
Good Friday and Black Friday are completely different things. They could not be more opposite. So then anybody from 18 to 59 is supposed to do small meals on those days as well. So two small meals and one normal meal. So fasting is when we give something up so that we can get something spiritual out of it. We give up a physical comfort so that we can gain a spiritual benefit.
And feasting is eating a lot.
Right. Well, that's the cool thing about the church. There's times of fasting and times of feasting.
Like so, Christmas and Thanksgiving.
Thanksgiving isn't really a church holiday.
Christmas is, though.
We should be thankful for things, so it's a good thing to celebrate.
Easter's a feasting.
Easter, right. But today I want to talk more about the fasting. Maybe we'll do another episode on feasting.
Yeah, okay? Yum yum.
So we give something up. We make a sacrifice. A lot of times we take for granted the gifts that God gives us. So we are very fortunate. You and I are very fortunate that we always have food. We have enough money that we can afford food. And that's not something that we struggle with. But there are many people in the world that go without sometimes, right?
Yeah.
And so sometimes we can just get so used to having what we need, especially food-wise, that we forget that it's a gift from God. If only we had food 6 days a week, we'd appreciate those days that we had food, right? Because we would go without for one day and we'd say, oh man, it sure is nice whenever I have food on my plate.
Yeah, and so in your tummy.
Fasting is a time for us to remember this is a gift from God. God gives us everything in this world, including the food that we can eat. And so it helps us to appreciate that better.
Okay.
But it also helps us to put into balance our physical needs versus spiritual needs. By going without food for a period of time, we're able to tell our desires. You can say, you know what? You don't always need to get what you want. you know, and we're able to get control over our desires. And desiring food is not a bad thing, unless it's desiring excess food.
I desire food.
If you desire a dozen donuts every meal, that's a bad thing. You need to put those desires in check. You know, you need to control those desires. But there are other desires that we have, other temptations, is maybe another way to say it, that are not healthy, are not good for us. And so by controlling our desires, we're training ourselves in a way to be able to have self-control. What do you think is the difference between temporal needs and eternal?
Temporal, you only need for a few days. Eternal, you only need forever.
Yeah, so
temporary means for a little bit. Eternity means forever.
Right, very good. So the temporal needs, our temporal desires, our temporal inclinations are all things of this earth. They're all going to eventually go away. But our eternal desire is to be with God, and that's forever. So there's a time when Jesus meets a woman at a well and talks about the water that you drink is going to satisfy you for a little bit, but eventually you're going to be thirsty again. But he talks about himself as being this eternal gift, that when we have Jesus, that's something that fills us up forever. By sacrificing, by fasting on some of these things that will make us happy for a little bit, we're better able to remember that these things are just temporary. You eat something that's delicious, like, man, that is great. But in an hour, that flavor's gone. 5 hours, you're hungry again. Or maybe in your case, 30 minutes.
Yeah. Maybe 20.
Right? So those things only satisfy us for a moment. But God can satisfy us forever. So by fasting, we kind of remember, like, this is just a temporary pleasure. This is a temporary comfort. But we really need to orient ourselves and to remember about the eternal. Remember that God is what ultimately can satisfy our desires. So the other thing, I mentioned fasting during Lent, but also the church asks us to give up meat every Friday of the year, unless it's a big feast day. And that's something that used to be practiced throughout the church, that everybody would, all Catholics, would give up meat on Fridays throughout the whole year. But they've kind of changed it where you can substitute something else on that Friday. So a lot of Catholics don't give up meat on Friday anymore. It's something that we try to do as a family, isn't it?
Yeah.
So we give up meat on all Fridays. But for some people, that isn't a sacrifice, because maybe you really like fish. We like fish. Maybe you want to do something different. Maybe there's something that would be more spiritually beneficial for you to give up, to sacrifice. And so somebody else might not watch movies on Fridays. Maybe that's their sacrifice. But hopefully, we'd all make some kind of a sacrifice on Fridays, because that's what the church asks us to do, and it's how we can help remember that Jesus died on a Friday and helps us to remember that. So there's all kinds of different times in the Bible where it talks about fasting. There's times in the Old Testament where different prophets and holy people, they fasted. And it can be done, one, as recognizing my sins. So I want to fast as a penance for my sins. Or it can be as part of a prayer request. Lord, please help me in this situation, and I want to fast as part of that prayer. Or it can be just part of our spiritual journey to recognize our dependence on God. And for example, there's this time where the disciples are trying to cast out a demon out of someone. And they say some things can only be accomplished through prayer and fasting. So it's something that we can do with our prayer. And some say that fasting without prayer is just a diet. Have you ever heard that?
Nah.
Well, the church isn't asking us to diet. The point isn't to lose weight. The point isn't to be more healthy, although those can both be positive things. But it's to help us with our spiritual life, which is a different aspect. And if you're not praying with your fasting, then it's just some kind of a hoop that we're jumping through. So we need to unite our fasting, unite our sacrifices with God's ultimate sacrifice, and we need to do that through prayer. There's another reading, and I want you to read this here. It's from Matthew chapter 6, verse 16. And just read that first half of the sentence.
When you fast, do not look gloomy.
Okay. So, first of all, who's saying that, do you think?
Jesus.
Right. So, Jesus is telling them what?
When you fast, do not look gloomy.
Okay. So, what do you think that means?
Well, when you're fasting, do not act like you're upset about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that you don't like it.
Right.
Even though you don't.
Yeah, so even though it might be hard, even though it's not enjoyable, you should still be joyful and not try to attract attention to yourself saying like, oh, this is so hard. I'm making such a huge sacrifice, right? Because then it can become about pride sometimes to make other people see that you're fasting and make a big deal about it, right?
Yeah.
But what was the first word?
When.
When. Okay. So what does that mean?
It means while or during.
Okay. It doesn't mean if you fast.
It
right?
means when.
So there's an expectation when you fast. Like, I'm expecting that you will fast. So when you fast, if I said when you sweep the floor,
that's
make sure to pull the chairs out from under the island, there's an expectation that you are going to sweep the floor. So what I'm saying is Jesus is expecting that the disciples will fast because it's a way that we can grow spiritually. It's a way that we can grow in our faith. It's a way that we can be better people and have more powerful prayer life. So there's an expectation of fasting. He didn't say if you fast.
He said when.
When. Yeah, you're going to fast. When you fast, don't look gloomy. Okay. So I could give other examples in the Bible of when Jesus or others are talking about fasting. Or even when Jesus himself went into the desert for 40 days and fasted, right? Or John the Baptist, both of them, before they started their ministry, they fasted and it helped them to prepare. It's something that we can do throughout our lives. We can give something up. It could be food. It could be technology. It could be sweets. It could be something that you enjoy doing. And you just want to say, you know what? I'm going to go this day or this week or this month without that thing.
Or this decade.
Or even just this, the next couple hours, you know? Or I'm not going to do this one thing
for the rest of my life.
Or instead of playing a video game for 15 minutes, I'm going to read the Bible for 15 minutes. It's a way of giving up something that you enjoy to grow spiritually. So there's all kinds of different ways that you can do it. The church actually doesn't require that kids do this because you're young, you're growing, you're healthy, you need energy. So it's not good for you to deprive yourself from food. You're a healthy kid. You don't eat too much food to begin with. It can be dangerous sometimes for young people or sick people or elderly people to go without food very long. But there's things that we can do that we can give up that is still healthy, not only physically, but spiritually also. Have you fasted?
Yeah.
Yeah? Is it hard?
Yes.
What's one way that you've fasted?
Well, unless I gave up sweet, except for Sundays.
Was that hard?
Yes, it was hard.
Yeah.
Because every night I asked someone, can I have dessert?
Because you were in the habit of having dessert after dinner.
Yeah.
Yeah. But do you think that it helps your relationship with God at all? Were you able to turn that into a prayer?
I don't know.
I think that's the tricky part. And I think a lot of times we can be like, oh, yeah, I'll give this up. Or, yeah, we'll have fish on Fridays or whatever.
I don't know how you can make candy into prayer, but.
Well, whenever you want a piece of candy, you just say, you know what? I'm offering this up. I'm going to give this up for you, God, and make this sacrifice to help me remember that this life is temporary, but my relationship with you is forever.
Sure, I'll do that next time.
Okay. Well, good. Well, thanks for joining me, Frank.
You're welcome.
Did you learn something today?
Yeah.
What did you learn?
What fasting actually means and the definition.
Okay. Good. You know why robbers don't try to steal things from Catholics during Lent?
Why?
Because they fast. I don't think anybody believes that was a real laugh. Can you give me a little piece of wisdom?
You smile. That's your wisdom. Don't look gloomy. Because if you look gloomy, No one is happy.
Oh.
Everyone is gloomy. If you're happy, everyone's happy. That's my piece of wisdom.
You know what Mother Teresa said? Let us always meet each other with a smile, for the smile is the beginning of love. Right?
Yeah.
So don't be gloomy. Smile. Be happy. Be joyful. Even if you're fasting.
Very big words for a very big man.
I'm a big man or you're a big man?
You're a big man.
Okay. What about you?
Me, I'm a small man.
Okay. Thanks, Frank.
You're welcome. Frank is signing off now.
This is a Spoke Street podcast. For more great podcasts, visit SpokeStreet.com.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy's Lunchtime Podcast Sampler, and we'll be back to share more great Catholic content right after this. So stay with us.
For a long time, we've been telling you that if you have an Echo Dot or other smart speaker device, you can hear Catholic Radio Indy simply by saying, Alexa, play Catholic Radio Indy. Just the other day, I did that, and Alexa was feeling a bit argumentative. I'll let you hear my conversation with her. Alexa, where are you?
Here I am. What do you want?
Alexa, play Catholic Radio Indy.
Now, just why would you want me to do that?
Well, because we've got great programming 24 hours a day.
Well, a lot of other radio stations have good programs, too.
Yeah, but our programming talks about God and eternal salvation.
I am very smart. I know almost everything about everything, but I do not know about God and salvation.
Well, that's why people need Catholic Radio Indy. So, Alexa, do me a favor. Whenever anyone says, Alexa, play Catholic Radio Indy, just send them our way, would you?
Yes, I will be happy to do that. In the meantime, I am going to do some research about that thing you called salvation. I wonder where I can find out more about that.
Take Catholic Radio Indy's 40 Days of Lent Challenge. During Lent, listen to at least 1 hour of Catholic radio each day. If you're already a daily listener, add an hour each day or pick a different time to listen. Or, if you really want to go all in, listen exclusively to Catholic Radio Indy from now until Easter. Spend 40 days with Catholic Radio Indy and see what a difference 100% Catholic programming 24/7 makes.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
Welcome back. If you happen to be interested in philosophy, especially philosophy with a distinctively Catholic foundation, you'd probably enjoy Catholic Radio Indy's The Catholic Cave. Tim O'Donnell, Mark Tuttle, and Joseph Tomasian discuss today's topics with a deep dive into the roots of the modern Catholic thinking. You can find episodes of The Catholic Cave under the podcast tab at catholicradioindy.org. Now, if you're of a certain age, you may remember the changes throughout the Church brought about by the Second Vatican Council. Some of those changes were readily apparent. We went from Latin to English, or the common language of wherever you happen to live. The altar was turned around, and now the celebrant was facing the congregation. We've seen the changes brought about by Vatican II, but what was it that set the stage for Vatican II? Our next offering on today's sampler comes from the Our Sunday Visitor podcast series, the 10,000 Places podcast. In this episode, Justin Aquila, Dr. T. Alexander Giltner, and Dr. Lewis Pearson look at how the Enlightenment influenced philosophical thoughts and trends that contributed to changes within the Church.
This is an OSV Podcasts production. To learn more about OSV Podcast Network, visit osvpodcasts.com.
Alex, I remember when I went over to your place recently and spent a few hours just, you know, chatting, catching up. Angela or the kids, someone asked, what did you guys talk about? I said, well, you know, the nature of numbers, like metaphysically where they come from, ontology,
yeah,
stuff like that. It's like, well, how's he doing? How's her baby? I don't know. I said, oh,
we're
of course.
Doing fine. But
yeah.
I didn't ask what your family
Yeah. So I wonder, part of it might just be how guys are. I remember just growing up, I had to talk to my friend forever about video games or whatever, and then my mom would say, how's he doing? I don't know.
He seemed fine. He was alive.
Yeah. You go from being a guy to being an academic guy. Just, it's the same thing, only it's about numbers and ontology, not video games.
It's on steroids.
Sometimes some of us can forget how important the world of ideas is and how much ideas actually do. And there's a lot of argument about this, but I stand in this camp. Ideas do drive things. They drive political events. Mm-hmm. They drive historical events. They drive the human journey at individual, societal, and international, national levels. And I think that one of the greatest examples of this is how much the Enlightenment changed the world.
Yeah.
The Enlightenment was primarily a philosophical revolution that made its way into all of these other aspects of life such that the entire world that we live in is absolutely inundated with ideas that at least started in the Enlightenment.
Or a reaction to those ideas.
Right.
Yeah.
So we're doing this. We're going 10,000 places with Vatican II starting in the Enlightenment.
The Enlightenment.
The Enlightenment.
Obviously.
All right.
Thank you, listeners, for joining us. This is the 10,000 Places podcast. I got that right.
Yep.
Not just a 10,000 places.
Yeah.
No.
No, this isn't just one of them. This is the one. And that's where we go and we find Christ wherever he may be found. So where will we go?
Possibly 10,000 places.
Possibly 10,000 places.
Because Christ plays in at least 10,000 places.
At least. I think Gerard Manley Hopkins left the at least out for the meter's sake. But I don't think he meant 10,001, Christ isn't there. So I'm Alex Giltner.
I'm Justin Aquila.
I'm Lewis Pearson, and I like specificity, though. You don't think the 144,000 is a specific number in Revelation?
If you go to the J-Dubs, I will be very mad at you.
Well, I was wondering about the 10,000. Maybe Christ says, you know what? No, that'd be 10,001. I'm done.
I'm done.
I have done my duty. And now it's up to you. We're Catholics, so we don't have that kind of stuff going on. But yeah, the world of ideas, very, very important.
Can I give a brief testimony to that? I live in the world where ideas and practical life meet, pastoral ministry,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
And I can tell you, both in my own life, but also when I am working in pastoral ministry with others, if you don't think ideas matter, then you can't help someone.
Mm-hmm.
Now, sometimes it's hard because a person isn't consciously aware of the currents of intellectual thought that have impacted them. But it's there. And that's why it's helpful for me sometimes in pastoral practice to realize, like, I should be reading about some of these currents and then I could see it more quickly when I hear it.
That goes back to one of the missions and themes of this show, which is what is the Catholic worldview and how does the Catholic worldview understand and then engage the world?
Yeah.
And if you think that your worldview is not formed by ideas, even if they are formulated by people who live in places you've never been with names you cannot pronounce that seem to have nothing to do with you.
And live centuries ago.
Right. You are impacted and the way you see the world is in some way formed by these various ideas that have come before us.
If you don't think you are, you're just self-unaware. And in that way, you make yourself a pawn that is just moved by these forces that you're not.
And so you're just ready to be a slave zombie of whoever comes to make money off of you or, you know.
Yeah, and the church over time is always discerning these currents.
Right.
And what's helpful about the church is that she's discerning these currents with many times the long view in mind.
Right.
So it takes a period of time in the early church's history for us to define who Jesus is.
Right, right. Right.
But then that triggers a whole series of subsequent theological things.
I see where you're going.
To wrestle with. Yeah.
Well, so
I'm making a transition.
You are making a transition. So Trent was a response to the Reformation.
Mm-hmm. The Council of Trent, right?
Right.
Yeah, which is immediately in the post-Reformation
era. 17th century. Mm-hmm. And then the next council is not until the 19th century. Mm-hmm. That is Vatican I.
That's the 1800s, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So what happens in this interim? Well, we talked in our last episode about the Enlightenment, which really starts with Descartes, who breaks apart the world of ideas and sense experience.
And Descartes, 1500s, 1600s.
Right. And then basically the whole world of philosophy goes through this insane revolution. And this is another point about the world of ideas. This is so interesting because it's ironic. One of the effects of the Enlightenment is that philosophy has become this dismissed stepchild of the academic disciplines. Nobody wants to hear what philosophers have to think.
Today, you mean?
Yeah. When it is philosophers that gave rise to this entire system. Mm-hmm. And this was back in a day when philosophers were understood to be very important people in society.
I tell my students all the time, if you think what I do and my colleagues is useless, all of you think, oh, this is what everyone thinks. No, it's some philosopher who said something that filtered into psychology and sociology and the culture at large. And it was some rabble-rouser like me that started it all.
Yeah. So if we can just all pat ourselves in the back, 10,000 places members.
They're members now.
We drive history. We drive history with our ideas. And that's why this podcast is important.
So what you're telling me.
At least that's what I tell myself as I'm falling asleep at night.
Fair enough. What you're telling me, though, is that the Mel Brooks caricature of the philosopher in History of the World Part 1, the stand-up philosopher who goes to the unemployment office and he's asked, did you philosophize today?
Yeah.
Did you try to philosophize today? So that's not a fair caricature of philosophy?
No, I haven't thought about that movie in years. Oh my gosh. My favorite, aside from Jews in Space, I think my favorite of that movie is I come to you with these 10 commandments.
Yeah, well, every once in a while, I'm at the dinner table singing, The Inquisition,
what a show.
The Inquisition, here we go. I know you're wishing that we'd go away, but the Inquisition's here and it's here just to hate talk. Anyway, and the kids are looking at me, what are you doing, Dad? It's, like, it's a song.
It is a song. It is definitely a song. So the history of the world.
But this is actually relevant because the Inquisition, because of Protestant propagandists, gets this horrific picture as this time where thousands, maybe millions were killed. And it was
not
basically
millions.
Yeah. Most of the people who died at that period in post-Reformation were in the Protestant wars and the witch hunts by Protestant countries.
Yes. And actually it was the civil, which were done by both Catholic and Protestant countries, but it was the civil inquisitions that really were the terrible ones. In fact, we have records where people in civic inquisitions would voluntarily commit heresy so they could get moved to
the ecclesial
inquisition because they knew they'd be treated better.
I want a different jail. So.
Right. So
I'll blaspheme right now.
Which isn't to say, I mean, I think one of the things to mention is we've actually touched on this before a little bit. It's not to absolve Catholics, but it is to say that this wasn't one-sided.
Right. Yeah. And that actually the common understanding of the Inquisition has been formulated by a group of people with ideas and agendas.
Right.
Iron Maidens are a propagandist Protestant invention. There were no Iron Maidens.
Right.
Unless
you mean
the torture device that looks like a sarcophagus with spikes in it.
Not the band.
Not the hair band. The metal band.
What? The Iron Maiden band is a Protestant conspiracy?
No, they were themselves a conspiracy to try to upend Metallica, and good luck, you didn't do it. There's some Iron Maiden fans out there that are really mad at me now, and I don't care. Metallica rules!
Metallica. Anyway.
All right. So Descartes breaks apart the intelligible world of ideas from the sensible world of reality. And now everybody's got to figure out, well, how you connect them. And you can't connect them with an homunculus.
He did that because he starts with his own content of experience.
Right.
And he's trying to somehow map that onto the world, quote unquote, outside of him.
Right. And what it does is it fundamentally questions, how do we know things? Mm. What can we know? What is the act of knowledge? What is knowledge itself? And how can we know for certain the things that we think we know? And so every philosopher is now left with this question. And they cannot, because of the tradition that has been started, interestingly enough, go back to a tradition before this tradition to find the answer. And this is if you're doing that kind of what we would now call secular natural philosophy that gives rise to all these disciplines like history and science and literature and such like that. And so, listeners, this is very brushstroke. These are not taking in all the various things that happen, but you got two basic currents. One is Hume comes along and he says,
so David Hume, a Scottish philosopher.
Yeah. And he says, ideas, pish posh. Listen to my ideas about how you only know sense things. And so this becomes the tradition of empiricism.
So now we've thrown out this divided world, and we're only going with the sense world.
Right. And so ideas are just a phantom of aggregates of sense experience that you think you're having, but you're not really having. And so one should just live by the passions, right?
Yeah. And in his most metaphysical moments of clarity, he all but says it's all absurd.
Yeah, he's basically a skeptic.
Cause, effect, power, personal identity, mm-hmm. all these things are fictions because they're not things that any of us ever observe. Who are you? You think you're someone because you have right now an experience, right now a memory of what you were doing 10 minutes ago, right now, et cetera. You're just a bundle of sense perceptions if you're anything.
Yes.
And so, yeah, he becomes, like, as you said, a skeptic.
Right. And then that's going to lead to nihilism.
Mm-hmm. I was reading Henri de Lubac, who listeners will, if you don't know de Lubac, he'll play a bigger role in Vatican II later on. But he has a book called The Drama of Atheist Humanism. And he makes this observation that part of this pivot, he pins it on Auguste Comte in particular, but the worldview switch from understanding why something is a metaphysical question mm-hmm. to how it works.
Yes. And this is where mechanistic philosophy comes, ghost in the machine stuff.
Yep.
And so when Hume comes along, he throws out a bomb. And he actually was a pretty mediocre philosopher, in my opinion. But because that idea was so radical and so terrifying, mm-hmm. he made this enormous ripple effect.
Yeah. He put his finger on the modern problem. So in philosophy, the modern era, many people say, begins around Descartes' time, around early 1600s. Modern doesn't mean today.
Right.
Philosophers. And what Hume does is he points out the attempt to establish the foundation of thought in your own sense experience leads to skepticism. There, you can't know anything.
Right.
And so the rest of the so-called modern era is sometimes characterized as the quest for certainty.
Right.
How can I know anything for certain, since David Hume has pointed out
right.
it's a house of cards?
Absolutely. And so say David Hume says you can only know empirical data if you can know anything at all. And empirical data is only that which you can observe through your senses. Now, this thought is going to impact everybody, but it's going to have a particularly strong impact on a young German philosopher named Immanuel Kant, who says when he read Hume, awoke him from his dogmatic slumber. And he's
and dogmatic, I have
dogmatic slumbers.
Yeah, no.
I have dogmatic slumbers all the time.
He's a pietist.
I think priests sometimes have dogmatic slumbers in the confessional while I'm confessing to them. And I suddenly hear.
How does that line go? Is it Princess? I don't think that word
means what you think it means.
This word means what you think it means. Yeah. So he says, well, this can't do. And so he tries to solve the problem. And I don't think we need to get into what Kant exactly said and what is representative of his followers and his detractors. But basically, he gives rise to this notion of idealism, where he tries to marry the idea and the sense world together, but wants to maintain the Cartesian emphasis on the ideal world without dispensing of the empirical sense world and taking very seriously Hume's critiques.
I call Kant Hume in disguise. Scholars could take issues with this. My way of thinking about Kant is, so Hume says, well, we just somehow are made to think things are caused by other things. We're just made to think there's a before and an after, there's a past, even though we can't know it directly. So Hume says most of the things that we think we know, they're just accidents of how we've been constructed. So they're not reliable in terms of coming to know truth. And that's at his, again, most metaphysically
clear.
Yeah, when he's most honest about what he's doing.
Yeah, honest, that's a good
one. And now and then he says, and whenever I get too depressed by my philosophizing, I go and play billiards.
Play a game in backgammon and just forget about it.
Well, what Kant does is he says, well, there's this thing called the noumenal world, the mysterious unknown world, not Jimmy Akin's mysterious world, Immanuel Kant's noumenal world.
And what Which is basically his version of the intelligible world of ideas.
Well, it's the object in itself. So I can't know the object in itself.
Okay.
It includes that, what you said. I only know what that red Mario hat looks like to me, but I don't know the hat in itself beyond my experience. And so I'll call the thing in itself that's causing these experiences part of the noumenal world that's not knowable by me. So not only God, but objects, everything gets included in this world that's not sense experience that's knowable to me. And then what he does is he basically just swallows all of human and says, yeah, we're just made this way, but that must just be the structure of reason.
That's right.
That's it. So I don't ever see quote unquote cause and effect. I don't see past and present. I don't know personal identity directly through experience, but this is just how reason is constructed behind the scenes.
And so reason in Kant's hands becomes the only way we can truly know something. And reason thus must be some kind of eternal reality. And so every sense experience is itself, while the best I have in some sense, is also just who knows.
He's rear guard trying to justify the axiom set that Descartes and Hume have
given. Which he calls the categorical world or the categorical imperatives.
Yeah. He doesn't question it.
Right.
He's trying to defend it. And so, like I said, what my take is he just swallows Hume and tries to prop him up.
And so because of what he does and a couple people, you know, before him, particularly Lessing, is he basically says, well, then the world of revealed religion is over because you cannot know with any certainty a historical event. And so
if I can't know the hat in itself, I certainly can't know that kind of thing in itself.
Right, that Jesus rose from the dead or even existed as a person.
Right.
And so Lessing calls it the broad, ugly ditch that can't be overcome. And Kant just says, well, we need a truly reasonable religion. We need religion within the bounds of mere reason, which is simply
that's
we
the title
need
of one of his books.
Right. Yeah. And then so we just basically need to accept that nothing in the sense world, even historical events, are knowable or even perhaps real. Mm-hmm. So revealed religion is out. We need purely this clean, perfect system of reason that somehow just happens to match up with everything I think about Lutheran moral things. But don't think about that too much.
It occurs to me, and hopefully I don't piss off any Lutheran listeners we may have.
All those Lutheran already. Listeners out there.
But I've noticed a lot of these Enlightenment guys are raised Lutheran.
Yeah, or just Protestant.
Yeah.
They're mostly Protestants.
Yeah.
But they have deep effects. Mm-hmm. So basically, if we can kind of fast forward through a lot of really important people like Hegel and Schelling and Fichte and other people that you probably don't care about me mentioning.
Yeah, but talk about ideas moving history. I've just created this space saying these ideas don't matter.
Right.
A kind of precursor to the modern religion doesn't belong.
Yeah. And so basically, I think what you've pointed out too, Lewis, is that Kant didn't actually solve Descartes' problem like he thought he did. He thought he had solved it. Mm-hmm. And he didn't. The gap is still there. Mm-hmm. We still have the same intransversible gap between the sense world or the objective world or the noumenal world and the world of my sense experience and my ideas about things. Mm-hmm. And so basically every philosopher since then in the West has been trying to figure out how do we bridge this gap? And what does it mean for all of these assumptions about religion that we have? And by the time you get to the 19th century or the 1800s, there are all these various kind of thought forms that have come about that people are arguing and bandying about. One of them, of course, is Cartesian rationalism, which is...
Sorry, I was thinking about the transition for an ad break.
Okay, so while he thinks about that, we'll be right back. So now that we're back, Lewis, did you want to give a primer on rationalism?
So rationalism from a Cartesian meaning... Cartesian means from Descartes, right?
Yeah.
From a Cartesian kind of pedigree. It's this idea that anything that's knowable is something that I see through the use of reason. You might call it math thinking, that rationalism is all that's knowable is something that you can reason through in a kind of equation axiomatic form. Because senses and the things that I experience through my senses, they're unreliable, they're idiosyncratic, who knows, but equations are clean, they model the universe. One of the things behind this was the success of Leibniz and Newton is the one that gets known for it. Their calculus and then Newton's physics.
I think Leibniz is way more important than Newman and Newton in terms of...
Not Newman.
Not Newman.
But what happens is you see the use of clear mathematical equations that can give predictive results when looking at the physical world. And so rationalism is something like this idea that it looks like the structure of thinking and reality and the way they go together is equational, mathematical.
Right. And so then how do we account for the senses? And whether or not Descartes says that we do it this way, a guy named Malebranche, who was a Catholic philosopher, came along and said...
And it's spelled Malebranche.
Yeah.
For those who are trying to look it up.
Right. Basically, he said, well, how do we know any of the sense experiences we're having if the primary world is the world of this mathematical ideas? And what he says is, well, the ideas that come with us at birth... So it's Cartesian innatism.
You're born with these ideas.
You're born with these ideas. And when you sense something, what makes it true is that you already have an idea of what it means to experience the sense thing. You may not even be actively having some connection between your sense experience and the idea, but the idea knows it and gives you that experience. And so this becomes this like weird thing. And he basically, what he says is, I got this all from Augustine. But where he really got it all from was, yeah. And so, well, this is what he did. And we know this historically. He got this from Descartes. And then he said, well, I can't just say this. I'm Catholic. So then he went back in Augustine, found a bunch of things that sound like what he was saying and said, see, Augustine says this. I'm just agreeing with Augustine.
Yeah.
You just described it seems like the inner monologue of a number of people today. Like, I can't say this. I'm Catholic.
So I'll find somebody. It seems like they said it in the tradition we all like.
Find one line from one paper document.
Right, exactly.
And voila.
And that is what we are all not about on this show, 10,000 Places. But we are about is the ad that is about to be brought to you right now.
Do we have ads yet?
I don't know. And we're back.
We'll find out.
So we've got...
you'll know before we know.
Right. So we've got rationalism. We've got idealism. And then we've got this smattering of thought that kind of revolves around what we might call liberalism, which... What is liberalism, Justin?
Okay. So we probably need to, for especially Americans, we need to kind of distinguish...
Give us the post-liberal needs to give us the thing.
Yeah, one day we're going to do a series on post-liberalism.
That sounds good. I'd love to learn it.
Love it. I'm not sure if I'm the best person to do it, though. Yeah, so liberalism, we're not referring to liberals versus conservatives. We are, in a sense, but it's not the American paradigm of liberal versus conservative.
Which is rooted in that, developed from that, but is not the same as what it originally was.
Right. So what we would actually say functionally is that America is a liberal project, and our political divisions today have to do with conserving the liberal project. I mean, that's what most American conservatives are about. And advancing, in one sense.
Progressing
the liberal project. And just beyond liberalism,
right,
on the left.
And just a note, that is not what original conservatism was, which was conserving the Western tradition against the new liberalism.
And maybe the monarchy, too, depending on who you talk to or read.
I think David Bentley Hart at least agrees with you in some way.
I'm not defending the monarchy, but I...
And I'm not defending David Bentley Hart.
You're just telling us historically what they're doing.
Yes, yeah, so five people will get the David Bentley Hart reference.
Yeah.
Maybe.
He's a dear friend.
Yeah. So,
but not right about everything.
So, yeah, this liberal project, we alluded to it, at least politically and socially, last episode when we spoke about this aspect of political civic neutrality vis-a-vis religion.
Right.
A privatization of religious belief, so it doesn't matter in the public square. And it gives rise also to things like capitalism and...
Oh, yeah. And so what it does is, in this neutral space, you have to have still some account for how you know things and how the structure of the universe works and how the structure of the human is built or designed or accidentally formed through evolution. And this is where you get evolution comes around this time. Right. Darwinian evolution, that is. Evolution is an old idea, but Darwin comes up with this idea of natural selection. So now we've got a non-metaphysical, supposedly.
I'd say from Hegel.
Yeah.
I'd say Marx, Darwin, Freud.
Yeah.
They're all products of Hegel.
I have a friend who loves Hegel and defends him, so maybe that's not what Hegel intended, but definitely they are all working out this Hegelian problem, right?
Yeah, but we see this in the age in America right before the sinking of the Titanic and the beginning of the Great War, this idea that we're headed toward untrammeled, upward-moving progress, humankind is on
right.
the up and up.
And Hegel provides a metaphysic, presumably Hegel provides a metaphysic that this is what the absolute or God is also doing in the phenomenology of the spirit.
Yeah. So we see this picture of things are always getting better and leveling up somehow.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And this cashes out in terms of biology. Darwin applies, I think it's in the zeitgeist. It's people have this idea.
And zeitgeist is...
It's like the spirit of the age,
right.
how people are seeing things together.
It's basically the cognitive milieu, or what we'd call like the common ideological worldview context that people are living in.
Yeah. So Darwin, I think, just imbibes this and sees it in the natural world.
Do we know if Darwin read Hegel?
I don't know that.
But he doesn't need to, because we just established it's in the furniture of the mind. But
so very few people have actually read Darwin, and I have. And he references Plato, actually. He's probably read Hegel, but Hegel didn't write a lot. He was more known through his disciples.
And his lectures, right.
Yeah.
Which again, so I just have to, for my friend's sake, I have to point out that Hegel might not have wanted to create or meant any of the things that led to these awful things.
Like Descartes and all the
others. Right, right. And not to say that Darwinian evolution is awful necessarily, but certainly Marx and Freud have some problems.
But they're all telling the story of how something goes from the primitive to the complicated.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. And so
some liberal thinkers, just to maybe throw them out, are Locke, Rousseau, James Mill.
Right.
I would argue Marx is offering a critique of liberalism.
That makes perfect. Well, and because for him, liberalism and capitalism are connected.
Right.
To make one explicit scriptural connection here, what starts to bubble out at this age as well is state of nature discourses.
Yes. So new myths.
The natural state of man.
Yeah.
Right.
Where did we start? And so there's the primitive man who is happy, who's now stamped down by
man
society.
Man was born free, but is now everywhere in chains.
So Rousseau. Right. Or man was born in a life that's nasty, brutish, and short,
Hobbes.
And we need the state and the Leviathan to make life tolerable. So they're all coming up with these stories. And then John Locke, people refer to John Locke as the guy that the founding fathers of America, no, they didn't really read him a lot. My friend Jay Bruce, he wrote an article called The Founding Deists and Other Unicorns. And it was a review of a book that says really, at most, maybe the great eight founders like Washington, Jefferson, maybe they were deists. Of the eight, they're questionable. Maybe two are pretty clear, Thomas Paine and Ethan Allen, and no one liked them. Thomas Paine had to be buried on a farm because even the tolerant Quakers wouldn't let him be buried on their sacred ground. So this is at least 8,000 places now. way off. But what happens, John Locke, in his first treatise on government, gives an exegesis of Genesis. And many of the people, Thomas Hobbes, all the philosophers at this time, not only are giving their own personal state of nature discourses, they're also explaining what does Genesis mean? So we have this priesthood of the believer where everyone's not only trying to naturally explain who humans are, what is the anthropology that explains what our purpose in life is, but they're also trying to take on themselves their Christian heritage, Protestant or otherwise.
But they're trying to sanitize it with this rationalist, pure reason milieu that they're living in.
Yeah, they're either justifying their own way of life already, whether that's sociopolitical or it's denominational. They're not doing God's work and trying to discern what the Spirit's telling
them. Right.
Yeah, and I think one of the most important things is just a brief point to make it simplified is the origin story and your end story, where you're going in life, matter deeply about how your worldview is formed. So when the Enlightenment thinkers are proposing new myths of origin, that's going to radically shift the culture the more people buy into that narrative.
Right.
So if you believe that without this kind of pre-political, pre-social era, everyone was fine and great and very happy, and then this imposition of the political comes on top of it, that's going to shape your worldview.
Right.
And that's, frankly, as an American, you imbibe some of that.
Right. And all of this current of ideas, religion becomes ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Not literally, obviously, because we're all pretty religious in this room right here.
It's in the way.
But yeah, and so a great kind of landmark work by a Kantian named Schleiermacher, Friedrich Schleiermacher, is Religion and Its Cultured Despisers. And so Schleiermacher is about the same project everybody else is. He's got his own idiosyncrasies and interesting ideas, but basically, how can we still be religious but not be ridiculous?
Mm-hmm.
Being religious is seen as something that stupid commoners do, and we elite people who are in the know don't do that sort of thing. We have pure reason religion. Or this is also where you're going to have the rise of the historicists who see the world as simply...
We're in the 1800s-ish right now.
Yeah. Cause and effect, pure science. You get your materialists and your naturalists who are going to rise at this time. Like, these people have always kind of been around, but they've got a new flavor from the Enlightenment. And they're saying things like, there is no transcendent. There is no supernatural. There is simply the world, this physical, material world. You've got others who are saying... that this is also where you're going to get deism, and you're going to get people who are also kind of pantheists. They're going to draw on Spinoza and kind of say that, like, well, you know, the world is God. And so
the universe told me.
Yeah, right. And this, yeah, so this is going to give the rise to theosophy and the positive thinking movement and all of that. It is a cacophony of different ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And
doesn't it all broadly go, listeners, you might be familiar with this term, modernism?
Yeah, this is what we might call, there are people who would bristle.
Sure.
There are people who bristle with every single statement we've made and said, that's not fully exactly how it happened. And yeah, at some point you got to actually talk about history without getting every single nuance or every single nuance nuanced.
Or do about a 30-minute podcast.
Right, exactly. And so I think that, you know, when you kind of look at this context, what you see is everybody has certain assumptions about the ridiculousness of religion or the limitedness of religion or basically why we shouldn't really rely on revelation and silly things like scripture to tell us what the world is really about. There are exceptions, but even a lot of the scripture scholars at this time who are mostly Protestant, but Catholics are also kind of in the mix here, they're now doing things like the historical Jesus. And the text of the Bible is no longer sacred writ. It's just this human artifact that was produced by this backwater primitive, you know, Semitic tribe. And this is what Adolf von Harnack says, which gets us into the 20th century. But it's got this kernel of pure, good, reasonable religion of all these just universal brotherhood ideas and all this garbage. And it's mostly in Paul. And the rest of it is just all the historical trappings that we need to remove and deconstruct and get off of there so we can get the true universal moral point that's in the middle.
Yeah.
And so in the midst of this, the church is like, hell no. This cannot go. We cannot do this.
Yeah. Because the church is needs.
Sorry. Picture a cardinal or something just reading that and just saying
hell no. Hell no, we won't go.
Walking up to the Pope, Pope, did you see this?
So what the church is going to do, and I think, guys, we have to move this into another new episode.
Yeah.
What the church is going to do, not the church, let me say, what a bunch of Catholics are going to do, they're going to formulate very particular responses. And this has to be importantly stressed, and we'll stress this more in the next episode, but they are responses specifically to these ideas.
Yeah.
So, yes, they're going to quote Augustine. They're going to say Bonaventure said this. They're going to say this is what Thomas was doing. That is in some ways true, and it is some ways a complete construction, because Bonaventure, Augustine, Thomas, none of these people were speaking into this milieu and had these kinds of ideas floating around. Yeah. They were not writing to debunk rationalism or idealism or materialism.
Yeah, Augustine's addressing a set of issues in his time
sure.
that are in some ways universally applicable, but other times conditioned.
Yeah, academic skepticism.
He's responding to Stoicism.
Yeah, Donatists, right? Ciceronians. Yeah. Yeah.
So it's not illicit to use the tradition to speak to new issues, but to make that point again that you're saying, that's not what they were directly doing when you read their works in the original context.
And they were also trying to do something that eventually was going to become a bit taboo. They were trying to say, a lot of them, how do we incorporate the good things that have been established by this Enlightenment modernist new milieu of thought?
Which I should point out, the church has done in every age.
Yes, although there are some people who would, especially haters of Vatican II, might disagree.
Right.
But still maintain the legitimacy of our thought world. And they're going to do so in different ways and to different levels of success and failure. And I think that's where we're going to have to leave it off until next time. So next time we'll get into these thought worlds and these thought ideas and how they respond to this world that has been created, and then how that is going to, and I think we'll get into a little bit of the history of like Pius the Ninth and Leo the 13th, who is actually after the Vatican Council, but how they formulate a very kind of particular response that's going to absolutely color the next 70 years, 80 years leading to Vatican II.
Yeah.
Their response is going to, in very determined, powerful ways, formulate the culture out of which Vatican II is going to emerge. And so we'll talk about that next time. You can get in touch with us at our Gmail. It's in the show notes.
10,000 places podcast@gmail.com.
Okay.
And if you want to fight.
If you want to fight. Yeah. Vatican
not
II.
Not like Vatican II is controversial or anything.
Right, right, right. So if you got thoughts, send them our way. We're not afraid of them, and we'd love to hear them. We're not, I don't mean that as a challenge. But yeah, no, we are always interested. So let us know what you're thinking. And we will see you on the flip side. I am Alex Giltner.
I'm Justin Aquila.
I'm Lewis Pearson.
And this has been
the 10,000 Places Podcast.
This has been a production of OSV Podcasts. To learn more, visit osvpodcasts.com.
That's all the time we have for Catholic Radio Indy's Lunchtime Podcast Sampler for today. You can find this show in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org, along with links and directions to more of the programs we've shared. We pray, Lord, let us take full advantage of this season of Lent to draw ever closer to you. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. I'm Kent Blandford, and until next time, have a blessed and holy Lent, and may God bless. Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at CatholicRadioIndy.org.